Welcome to the Audible. I'm Stuart Mandel, joined by Bruce Feldman. It is the Monday of the final week of the college football regular season. Bruce and I, for the first time all season, were in the same place Saturday. We were in LA at the Fox Studios where we recorded our playoff preview show that I hope you guys saw on Sunday. And together we watched what I think was one of the best regular season college football games in a long time. The Ohio State-Michigan game. Frankly, I was getting nervous at the end watching it, and I had no vested interest. Where's the rank for you?
You know, it's the best game I've seen this year. I mean, I haven't seen as many games on TV as you have, but it was a ton of drama. I also thought, you know, because of the pacing of it, just kind of ratcheted up the drama. And obviously there were, you know, it's at the end of the year.
Explain what you mean by that with the pace.
Well, you know, especially a lot of the games I do that are, you know, they're Big 12 or Pac 12. You know, they're tempo games, they're going fast, and it's almost like, you know, the defenses aren't even set, you're maybe not set, and the ball is snapped and it's going. Whereas this, when I watched this, especially late in the game, it was, you know, it was just slow, almost bleeding out the clock a little bit. You're watching the clock go down. It felt very much like the tension you sometimes get in playoff baseball.
Right.
Where it feels a lot more like the moment and all what could go wrong on this play or how is this going to unfold. Everything seemed like it was heightened and escalated, which I thought really, really had kind of a wonderful effect as a fan who, just a fan of college football and not, like you, not have a vested interest in, oh, I need Ohio State to win because I, you know, whatever, or I need Michigan to win for this or that. Just watching it play out. And you kind of had the feeling of, okay, who's going to be the GOAT here, unfortunately. And the GOAT, not in the greatest of all time sense, and the GOAT who, you know, gets blamed for this.
I almost crawled up in the fetal position when Tyler Durbin, the Ohio State kicker, had to kick the last second field goal in regulation after missing the previous two. I felt so nervous for him. I think also to what you're saying, and we talked about this with LSU-Alabama, it's just so rare these days where a big game like that is decided by two great defenses. And obviously in regulation, you know, Michigan's defense really controlled that game. They would have won the game if not for Ohio State's own big defensive plays with Malik Hooker's pick six and two other turnovers. One of them was the center exchange. But anyway, when it's a great defensive game like that, you never know what any one play is going to determine the outcome. That's a lot different than watching, just as a random example, the Arizona State game the other night where, okay, one team's going to break off a 60-yard touchdown. Okay, here comes the other team. They're going to do the same thing. It just makes it that much more dramatic. But, of course, also, it's just the rivalry. You know, it was everything people hoped it would be when Michigan hired Jim Harbaugh and it became Urban Meyer versus Jim Harbaugh. Now, I will say I was not a fan of Harbaugh blaming the officials for the loss because, well, I'm not a fan of that in general, but it was just such a great game, and that's what you're focused on. I get it. He lost. He's emotional. He doesn't know any better than anybody else who watched it live or on television whether or not JT Barrett got the first down. That was just one of those close matter of inches things that nobody's ever going to know definitively whether he did or didn't get it.
Yeah, I think it's one of those cases where when we watched it and you and I were together on it, it's like if it had been ruled the other way, I don't think they could overturn it. You know, either way, I think it's hard to find conclusive evidence.
M. Goblog did like a frame-by-frame breakdown of it and actually, and this is a Michigan fan site, came to the conclusion that he got it by a couple inches. So I don't really get that hung up on it. There were so many other twists and turns in the game. So now Ohio State won that game, finishes 11-1, does not go to the Big Ten title game, and touches off the great playoff debate of 2016 that will probably play out all week long and certainly if Penn State beats Wisconsin on Saturday. Look, we did a whole show on this Saturday. I did a whole column on it Monday. We've run the numbers. We've gone through the resumes. End of day, I just look at it simply as this. Their job is to pick the four best teams. Nobody believes Ohio State is not one of the four best teams. We said as much on our show.
Michigan almost beat them on the road. And for a lot of people, Michigan dominated most of that game. Do you think Michigan is one of the four best teams then?
As of today, I do. On my new top 10 that I put up Sunday, yes, I had them number four.
Who's number five?
Number five is Washington. And Washington has a chance to beat top 10 Colorado and win the Pac-12 on Saturday. So I'm not definitively saying Michigan finishes as one of my four best.
Let me ask you this. If Washington beats Colorado, but not by quite as many points as Michigan did, the game was in Ann Arbor, do you think you'll move the Huskies, who would be a Pac-12 champ with only one loss, albeit with a worse non-conference schedule, would you move them ahead of Michigan?
I'd have to watch the game. I can't say for sure, but when I, the column I did that went up on Monday morning, I went team by team, top 20, top 10 record, top 25 records, wins over, 500 or better teams. And what you come to realize is those both Pac-12 teams are shaky on their, not, neither of them have resumes that compare to Ohio State for sure, and even Michigan, and certainly would be debatable with the Big Ten champ. What's kind of making this whole thing a little clunky is that I feel like the Big Ten's third and fourth best teams are playing in the conference title game. So you've got Ohio State and Michigan that just played this epic game, and I think you make a perfectly valid argument that Michigan's still a top four team. But the committee is never going to put two Big Ten teams in, neither of which played in the championship game. The only way Michigan's going is if we're talking about three Big Ten teams, which you seem to be going down that road.
Well, you know what? We're sitting in that room, and it was a blast to be with all our Fox colleagues, really, for the first time. I mean, at some point, it was like, oh, man, there is a scenario, and it's not even that far-fetched a scenario. Right. Like, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, but now this is what it would take, I think. It would take Clemson to lose to Virginia Tech. Virginia Tech has a puncher's chance to beat them. They're sure. pretty good and everything. And it would take Colorado to beat Washington.
Which is perfectly realistic, that one.
And Penn State beat Wisconsin. To me, there's a better chance of having three Big Ten teams make the Final Four than there is of having one Big 12 team make it.
I agree. And you go through the resumes. Here, I'll just read it off right now. This is Michigan, as of today, 3-1 against the top 10 with wins over Colorado. And by the way, that Colorado win becomes such a central part of it if Colorado wins the Pac-12, because they kind of box them out. Beat Colorado, Penn State, Wisconsin, lost Ohio State. 3-2 against the top 25 with Iowa now ranked in the AP poll, so they're 3-2. 7-2 versus bowl eligible. Remember those numbers now when I give you the Big 12s, who will be 10-2, not playing that 13th game. Oklahoma, 0-1 versus the top 10, the only one being Ohio State. 2-1 versus the top 25 with West Virginia. And I should note, I'm using Sunday's AP rankings since we don't have the new committee rankings. 5-2 against bowl eligible. I think Oklahoma State actually has a better case than Oklahoma if they win this game at Oklahoma. That would be 1-0, top 10.
Oklahoma got blown out at home by Ohio State because of that Central Michigan quirky loss.
No, believe it or not, this one sneaks up on you, but Pitt has entered the top 25, and they beat them out of conference.
Pitt beat Clemson at home and beat Penn State. Pitt has two of the best wins of anybody on the season.
And I think people don't even remember that Oklahoma State played them and beat them. So Oklahoma State, if they win this game Saturday, 3-0 against the top 25 with beating Oklahoma, Pitt, and West Virginia.
So I'm doing Bedlam. Tim Brando and Spencer Tillman and I are going to be in Norman on Saturday. Oklahoma versus Oklahoma State. What needs to happen for either team to get to the Final Four?
Kind of what we just talked about. I think the first domino is Colorado beating Washington. I do think Clemson needs to lose as well, because I do think two Big Ten teams are going to get in before we would talk about the Big 12. Again, Ohio State's win over Oklahoma looms large there if it's Oklahoma we're talking about.
Does Wisconsin winning help them more then?
A little bit, just because Wisconsin's Wisconsin's resume will be a little bit lighter than Penn State's if Penn State finishes this off. I don't think it's that big a difference, though. I don't think either Oklahoma or Oklahoma State is going to beat out the Big Ten champ. So you're looking at teams that are definitely in before. To me, Alabama and Ohio State are in today. It's over. I know people will debate Ohio State. Alabama, Ohio State are in. The Big Ten champ gets in before Oklahoma State. So now it becomes Colorado, if they beat Washington, against Michigan. And I think Michigan wins that argument. So then it becomes Michigan against Oklahoma State. This is if Clemson loses. So They're, I think it's slight. I think it's Jim Carrey and Dumb and Dumber slight chance for the Oklahoma. Now, what we can't account for is just how much the fact that they would be winning a conference championship. For instance, I just said they have Michigan has a better resume, but Michigan's not going to win its conference. Oklahoma or Oklahoma State is. I think that carries a lot of weight, but it's kind of balanced out a little bit by the fact that they're not going to win a conference championship game, so they're going to have the same record. It's a tough one to project. Another thing that I don't know that we get a good window into is if somehow Michigan did come back in the conversation and Penn State wins the Big Ten. I mean, they beat them 49-10.
Yeah, well, that's why I'm of the mind that if Penn State wins, you know, it's almost like if Penn State's going, you're going to have three Big Ten teams.
So you're there.
Well, I'm there, but look, I'm not there if Clemson and Washington win. If Clemson and Washington win, I don't think you're getting a big, you know, I don't think you're getting just Ohio State, and that's it.
Yeah, so it could be still this, after all this, it could play out very cleanly if Washington wins and Clemson wins. Year four would probably be Alabama, Ohio State, Clemson, and Washington. You don't give any credence to the possibility of 11-2 Wisconsin or 11-2 Penn State beating out 12-1 Washington.
No, I don't. Let me ask you this. You crunch some of the math. When we look at Wisconsin's schedule, Wisconsin's wins, right now I feel like Wisconsin's best attribute they have are close losses. I mean, yeah, they beat LSU. It was kind of a home game for them, but LSU is an 8-4 team.
I think Wisconsin's problem is that they lost to both Michigan and Ohio State. So this Penn State win, if they beat them.
What is Wisconsin's biggest selling point here? Tell me what the resume is, their biggest selling point.
If they win this game, their biggest selling point will be that they won what we would consider to be the toughest conference, and then Penn State would become their big win. But, you know, you look at it, they're 4-2 against the AP Top 25, and three of those wins are against teams ranked 21st, LSU, 22nd, Iowa, and 23rd, Nebraska. So, you know, I think...
That's my point, Stu. I mean, I would look at Washington's non-conference schedule is garbage. But when I look at if Washington beats Colorado, that's a good win. Washington thumped Washington State, which I think Washington State's better than Nebraska and Iowa. And they did it in Pullman. And, you know, they beat Utah on the road. Those aren't bad wins. And by the way, one other thing, they killed Stanford. And Stanford is a 9-win team. I think Stanford is actually as good as any win that Wisconsin has right now.
Yeah, I mean, because the thing that gives you a little bit of pause about Washington, as of today, before playing the Pac-12 title game, that Stanford team, which is ranked 17th in the AP poll, is the highest ranked team they've beaten. The other thing, and this is mostly optics that hurts them, is that Utah and Washington State dropped out of the AP poll this week, so that they're only 2-1 against the top 25.
Nebraska, after getting drilled by Iowa, may drop out also, though.
Well, I think in the committee rankings, Utah will stay in. I don't think Washington State will. They were never that high in Washington State to begin with. So I think Utah could stay in there. And yeah, Nebraska could drop out. We don't know that the committee will put Iowa into the top 25 like AP did, though I think, you know, having beaten Michigan and now Nebraska, I think they will be in. So one thing I want to just bring up, let's stop talking numbers for a second. When I talk about Ohio State and Penn State and their resumes aren't particularly close, one thing we don't really talk about is Penn State got really good by the end of the year. I mean, they're just blowing people out. They're scoring 45 points every.
The most underrated player in that conference right now, Stu?
Trace McSorley.
He is playing very, very well, and he's a really good fit for Joe Moorhead's system there. And they're a lot more than just Saquon Barkley. And I'm not saying that Trace McSorley should be a Heisman candidate now, but I don't think people realize how well he's playing. I think he's the best quarterback that's going to be in Indianapolis in that game on Saturday.
I'm leaning toward Penn State winning the game, and that's nothing against Wisconsin. I mean, Wisconsin, what do they want, 6 straight to end the season? But so did Penn State, and their offense has just kicked it into such a high gear. And so I think people are shortchanging Penn State a little bit because they're hung up on the first half of the season, Penn State, and not the second half. That being said, Penn State fans seem to think we should just throw out that first part of the season. Oh, all the injuries against Michigan, we hadn't gotten into our rhythm yet on offense. Well, you know, the whole season counts. And that's why, you know, I know people disagree with this, that it's not the end-all be-all to me if you don't win your division, you don't make the playoff, etc.
Let me jump in on that, because I literally had somebody just text me now saying, more I think about it, I think Penn State should go, if Penn State wins, it should go ahead of Ohio State. Why shouldn't they? They would have a head-to-head over them. They won the division, and they would have won.
The job is to pick the four best teams, and I believe Ohio State is the second best team in the country.
But they lost the game head-to-head. This isn't even anything subjective now, Stu.
I guess my larger point would just be, I mean, I actually had an interesting Twitter exchange about this with Doug Lea-Maurice from Cleveland Plain Dealer and Ralph Russo from AP. Doug said, if Penn State had scored four more points against Pittsburgh, would we even be having this argument? And no, we wouldn't, because they'd have the same record.
You know what, Stu? I disagree. I think we would still be having the same argument.
I don't
know
why. I think so.
No. I do, because no. I hate to, you know, evoke our friend Tim Brando, and you can't spell Brando without the word brand, evidently. I think there's a lot of people, look, they give Ohio State the benefit of the doubt because they won a title 2 years ago, and they are very talented. And I think they do the opposite with Penn State because they've been so mediocre for so long and nobody saw this coming.
Think about what you're saying. Because in that scenario where they beat Pitt, then they go and win the Big Ten. Not even I would say you're taking 11-1 Ohio State ahead of 12-1 Big Ten champion Penn State.
I bet you there are some people who would still think Ohio State would take them higher. They would rank, they would still rank them
I think
higher.
There'd be people that say, you know, I think they're a better team, but you know, it'd be kind of like TCU Baylor 2 years ago, right? Same exact record. Baylor beat them by a field goal. Baylor moved ahead of them on the last week. A lot of us, myself included, thought TCU was the better team. The game was decided by a field goal. It was at Baylor. Basically the same thing here, right? Ohio State lost by 3 points.
I don't like that example, and here's why I don't like it. Baylor and TCU are both fit in the category of upstarts. They were both, you know, really talented teams, but they were upstarts. They were not blue blood programs, whereas Ohio State has been a powerhouse. We give, you know, Urban Meyer a ton of, deservedly so, a ton of respect.
You're talking about Penn State like they're Northwestern. Penn State's a blue blood, too. I know they've been down after the sanctions.
Penn State has been so mediocre as it relates to the national college football scene. The only reason why people have talked about them at all in the national landscape in the past 10 years was for off-field scandal. It wasn't
correct,
for anything
correct
they did on the field. So let's not, I mean, that's why I think, to me, TCU and Baylor, to the national college football fan, are both side dishes or kind of off the, you know, from the margins. Whereas Ohio State in the last 5 years has been a true powerhouse. They won a national title. Penn State, you know, hadn't won a share of its conference in almost a decade.
Bruce, if Penn State were 11-1 right now, and Ohio State were 11-1, Penn State would be ranked higher than them in the committee rankings today, much less after they win the Big Ten championship.
I bet you're wrong.
No. I mean, look, here's my whole point on this, though, because I've heard people say, well, it shouldn't matter. They lost a close game to Pitt. The whole thing shouldn't be decided because they lost to Pitt. Well, that's only half of it. Ohio State went on the road in their big non-conference game and beat Oklahoma by 3 touchdowns. So here's my point. If you say they won the head-to-head and they won the division, that's all that should matter, then you're saying that September was an exhibition season, that the non-conference games didn't have any bearing on the season. All the games matter. You judge them on all 12 games. That Oklahoma win was huge for Ohio State. Penn State had a chance to beat not Oklahoma, but Pitt, who we just said is in the top 25 and lost. And that kind of set the table for the rest of the season.
I'm not disagreeing with you on that point. I'm just saying you're the same guy who, when Florida State was undefeated and had won a title, you had them behind teams that had lesser records. I mean, you're still, you know, about where Washington is with a one loss. And Washington's resume is every bit as good right now as Wisconsin. It's not like Wisconsin's loaded up with top 10 wins. So, I mean, I feel like you're trying to have it both ways here.
I didn't follow you on that at all. I have Washington ahead of Wisconsin.
I know, but you were talking about, like, well, would Washington be ahead of Michigan? Michigan has 2 losses. Washington has 1.
That's more the, I watched Ohio State and Michigan play a game that went to double overtime on the road. And if I believed Michigan was the third best team before, does that really change my opinion? No, but that's not how the committee operates.
You said you needed to see it on the field, whether you would move Washington. You know, do they need to beat them by 17 points, which is the margin Michigan beat Colorado at home? You said, no, I need to see it. That's not about the record or...
That's just about, I don't know what's going to happen in the game. Maybe Jake Browning gets hurt and isn't available for the playoff and you have to decide it based on that. But no, I fully anticipate next week that I would have Washington ahead of Michigan if Washington wins the Pac-12 game. Is that what you wanted to hear?
Yes, I conducted this exercise for 18 minutes to try to get you.
Try to get me to say that? End of day, everybody's focused on the wrong argument. You know, you can argue it till you're blue in the face about, look, on the show the other night, you asked Joel Klatt, right? You said, who do you think's more deserving, Penn State or Ohio State? And he said Penn State. And then you said, do you believe Penn State is better than Ohio State? And he wouldn't go there. It was more deserving, more deserving. They have made it very clear. They said it a million times. It's not most deserving. It's best. And so I think people are focused on the wrong argument. It's not Ohio State and Penn State. It's whether they would both get in. And that's where the Penn State versus Washington thing comes up.
Can I use this point then? If it's not most deserving, it's best. Do you have USC ahead of Colorado right now? You're a hypocrite. You are.
I do not have USC ahead of Colorado.
You're a hypocrite, Stu.
I'm not a hypocrite because I believe, because again, it's the same point I just made with Penn State. The whole season counts. I'm not throwing out that 1-3 start for USC. It happened. It you know, you have to hold them accountable for it. By the way, I do think there's a possibility the committee will move USC ahead of Colorado on Sunday if Colorado loses, and that would send USC to the Rose Bowl.
Well, they'd have the same record, same loss.
Sort of. I don't think it's a given because I've seen them, like Iowa last year, they did not punish them very much for losing the conference title game. I think they might treat Colorado effectively as a 10-2 team. But they did lose to USC. USC would have beaten both. They did beat both teams in the conference championship game. So, yeah, I think that's a slight possibility. But I do think you can't throw out September. If you do, what's the point? You might as well just go play two Sun Belt teams and a MAC team and whatever. Because you're saying, for example, if you're of the opinion, as many, many people are, that you should have to win your conference championship to get in. Joel Klatt flat out said I was everything that's wrong with college football the other day in the green room for suggesting that that shouldn't be the case. If you say it should only be conference champions, then what is the point of non-conference season? All that matters is the 8 or 9 games you play in conference. That's the only thing that determines who gets in the playoff. I think if we want them to play good teams out of conference, you have to reward that. You have to reward Ohio State going and beating Oklahoma by 3 touchdowns. If you don't, why did they play the game?
Okay, I think we should move on. Let's go Heisman quick. Lamar Jackson and Louisville struggled the last 2 weeks. They got blown out at Houston, and then this weekend lost to what I would say is a plucky but kind of mediocre Kentucky team. And people are like, okay, now the Heisman race has been turned upside down. And what I said to you on Saturday is where I'm still at. I don't think there is a viable number two guy ready to overtake him. I feel like I have a bunch of number three guy candidates, but I don't have a number two guy. Is there any chance anybody else could surge past him on your ballot that you will turn in next Monday?
I don't believe so. And look, in the moment Saturday, he lost to Kentucky. He had 4 turnovers that helped cost them the game. I thought, well, there's no way he can win it now, right? I looked it up. No player has won the Heisman losing his last 2 games of the season since Paul Hornung 60 years ago.
Paul Hornung was teams was like 2-8.
But you keep saying, oh, maybe such and such will step up. Maybe Jalen Hurts will step up. Jalen Hurts had 2 interceptions in the Iron Bowl. Maybe Jake Browning did have a big game the other day, but I think it's too late for him. Jabril Peppers, people are holding out for him. They lost the game. By Ohio State not making the conference championship, I think that rules out. First of all, JT Barrett shouldn't even be in the conversation, but I know he is for some people. Curtis Samuel, to me, is their better candidate, but he's not going to play the last week. I could go on and on. Mayfield and Westbrook have a chance against Oklahoma State to make that final statement. I don't think they're passing Lamar Jackson. The one guy who maybe possibly could do it is Deshaun Watson, because he has a chance to play one more game, have a huge game maybe against Virginia Tech, at which point people might say, well, wait a minute, he beat Lamar Jackson, and he just took his team to the playoff. Maybe we should be giving it to him. This would not be my thinking. I don't even have him in my top 5. I'm saying a lot of people might.
Yeah, I don't have him in my top 5 either, and I hate to say it, and Leinart and I got into it about a month ago over this, but it's the interceptions to me that give me too much pause.
Exactly.
You know, 14 interceptions. He's had multiple games where he's thrown 3 picks. One of them was the Louisville game. The other one was in the loss at home against Pitt. You know, I mean, there's other games where he's had 2 interceptions. I mean, 14 interceptions, you know, is quite a bit for a guy to win the Heisman. Now, if he goes off against Bud Foster's defense and has another, you know, five touchdown, no pick game, you know, I mean, that still would give him a strong, you know, a strong stat line. And in a lot of ways, it would probably surpass his numbers. I mean, in all likelihood, he's going to throw for more yards than he did last year. He's going to probably throw for more touchdowns. I don't know. I think he will get to New York if they win this game, but I don't think it's going to be much more than that.
And to his credit, he has really come on late in the season. I remember at one point looking at the passer efficiency ratings, and he was in the 30s. He's now 16th. That's actually two spots ahead of Lamar Jackson. But of course, Lamar Jackson has run for something like 1,400 yards on top of that. And this season, Deshaun Watson, yeah, that's a big difference actually from last year. Deshaun Watson ran for 1,105 yards last season. Obviously, that includes the playoff. This year, 444. So he's a great player. I still think he's a great player. Does he deserve to win the Heisman? Debatable. But to answer your question, he is the only guy left out there that could possibly pass Lamar Jackson. I guess it's a credit to just how dominant a season he had. I'm talking about Jackson now, almost 5,000 total yards, 51 touchdowns, that he could lose those last two games. And by the way, they weren't to Alabama. They were to Houston, who finished unranked, and Kentucky, who was 6-5 going into the game. But there's not somebody out there who I think is going to trump him.
If it's up to you and you can send four guys to New York, who would they
be? Oh, don't do that to me. I had enough trouble narrowing down my, because that was the hardest part Sunday, was not who should be number one. It was who should be 2 through 5. I put four guys, and then there were four other guys I could have traded places with them. I'll tell you what, the one I'm struggling with is your guy, Deontay Foreman. 2,000 yards, you would think automatically send him to New York. But doesn't the team come into it at some point? The team finished 5-7. His own fumbles contributed heavily to a couple of those losses down the stretch. I think ultimately he'll be there, but I did not have him in my top five, much to a lot of people's chagrin. You know who I did put in there this week, though? Adoree Jackson.
I don't even think Adoree Jackson's the best candidate on his team.
You like Sam Darnold.
I do like Sam Darnold, yeah.
Adoree Jackson has 4 return touchdowns on the season. He has 4 interceptions.
By the way, he was the one who Utah picked on when they beat them down the stretch.
That's the thing, right? Like, you know, I could put him in there for 1 week to celebrate his just unbelievable game he had against Notre Dame. He's actually not that great a cover corner.
I'm not sure he's the best cornerback cover guy in the Pac-12. I saw, you know, 6'8" Kevin King yesterday in Seattle. You know, Washington may have 2 better corners than him.
Colorado might have one too.
Yeah. I mean, he's big and physical and he can do a lot of stuff. Yeah.
Dory's not going to New York. I would imagine if Deshaun Watson wins Saturday, he will. I would imagine if Jake Browning wins, he will. I think Jalen Hurts will. I don't really know what the consensus is on him.
D. Westbrook should go, I think. I have him over Baker Mayfield just because I think when he got healthy, that's when Oklahoma took off. Now, obviously, if Baker got hurt, they probably wouldn't have
been. They might split the votes with each other. So that's who I think could be there. But I think you could make a perfectly good argument for Dalvin Cook to be there. I think you make a perfectly good argument for, nobody's going to buy this, but Christian McCaffrey ended up having a great season, not last year's stats by any means, but he ended up having a great season. Who am I forgetting?
Would you send McCaffrey and Dalvin Cook over Deontay Foreman?
I don't think I could send McCaffrey over him. Dalvin Cook is a great, great player. Had another big game the other night. No, I think you'd have to send the 2,000-yard rusher over them.
I mean, and by the way, he only played 11 games. He didn't get a chance to play against UTEP, which is a bad team. He probably would have run for a lot more. Of guys who play in Power 5 leagues, this is, I think, worth noting. So Deontay Foreman, 2,028 yards. The next Power 5 running back has almost 500 rushing yards less.
Yeah.
That's a big drop off.
When we say get to New York, we don't know how many, you know, last year there were only 3. You don't know how many will even get there. I think because there won't be much consensus after Jackson that you probably will get 5, maybe even 6. It's just like the year that Winston won. Jameis ran away with it, and then there was no separation between A.J. McCarron, Jordan Lynch, Andre Williams. Was Johnny Football there?
Oh, yeah, he was there.
The second year?
Yeah.
Really?
Oh, yeah. He just came for the party, but he was there.
I don't remember that. Okay. Yeah, there wasn't much separation there. It could be a lot like that.
Hey, we didn't mention him, and I had a little back and forth with a media friend of mine about me including Jalen Hurts in my top. I am fifth. Mm-hmm. Jalen Hurts, do you have any interest or no?
I have him in my top five. So if you were just going purely on stats, no, he doesn't. There are other guys you could put ahead of him. I think you got to say, wow, a true freshman quarterback who frankly ended up being a bigger part of their offense probably than most Alabama quarterbacks under Saban, is led them to an undefeated season and I assume playoff berth. That's pretty, if you're going most outstanding, that's pretty outstanding.
Yeah, no question. No question.
It wasn't like he, you know, this wasn't last year, you know, Jake Cooker handed off to Derrick Henry 40 times a game. In this case, Jalen Hurts is a centerpiece of their offense.
Yeah. I mean, I think he's completing over 71% of his passes in November. He's really come on. So I see it.
Hard to believe we're only getting to this on this point of the podcast, given how much time and energy we've devoted to this topic all of this year. I mean, all year. Is Texas going to keep Charlie Strong? Is Texas going to fire Charlie Strong? Is Tom Herman going to go to Texas? Maybe he'll go to LSU. And when it finally ended, it was almost anticlimactic. Charlie Strong made it impossible not to fire him, 5-7. And once that happened, to me, it was, despite all the dueling reports on the ESPN bottom line during the LSU A&M game, it was a no-brainer Herman was going to go to Texas.
Yeah, and that's what we said all along. I mean, I don't think it was any shock. It's just a matter of, I'll admit this, I was stunned that Texas came out and played the way they did. I thought they would have been able to handle TCU. I had TCU the week before, looked terrible at home against Oklahoma State. We're going to be without their most dynamic offensive player, Turpin, and their best defensive back. And Texas looked really loose when we saw him at practice on Thursday. I thought Charlie Strong sounded very candid and composed when we spent an hour with him later that day.
Look, this stuff that we report and put out there and debate and discuss, the players see and hear it. I do believe, I don't have any proof of this, that certainly Houston's performance against Memphis and maybe some other, I definitely think the outside noise that they were going to lose their coach probably had an effect on them. I definitely think, you've said yourself that the players and Deontay Foreman flat out talk about trying to save Charlie Strong's job. It has to affect your performance when you're feeling the pressure of, if I make one mistake, my coach is going to get fired.
Yeah, I mean, especially when you have such a young team, and that clearly weighed on them. And Charlie walked us, our crew, through what it was like the week before on Saturday at Kansas when this ESPN alert gets blasted out to their team.
To their phones, yeah.
And it just completely rattles them. And he's got guys coming up saying that they're going to get, you know, expect them to get fired. And he told us on the Monday press conference where all the players showed up, they were expecting him to resign there. And he said they came to, basically, they were not going to let me resign.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, now Tom Herman comes in and, you know, I expect really big things. You know, to me, this the confidence that I have that he's going to win big at Texas is very similar to the confidence I had when Florida hired Urban Meyer from Utah and when Washington hired Chris Peterson from Boise State. I mean, not all guys make that jump successfully, but given his pedigree, working for Mack Brown at Texas back in the day, working for Urban Meyer, leading a team to a national championship, you know, as I'm, people now, you know, forget this a little bit, as an offensive coordinator at Ohio State, he had to get a third-string quarterback ready to play in the Big Ten Championship and playoff, and he did, and they won. The guy's a good coach. I don't put too much weight on, oh, they lost to SMU, they lost to Memphis. You know, end of day, he beat three top 10 Power 5 teams at a Group of 5 school, and he's inheriting talent. There's, you know, 5-7 or not, there is a lot of good young talent on that team.
Yeah, no question. I mean, I think they will be a top 10 team next year, but
people asked this question when Michigan hired Harbaugh, how many years before he wins a national title there? How many years before Tom Herman wins a national title at Texas?
I don't know.
Well, no, let's tone it down a bit. How many years before he gets him to the playoff?
He'll do it within 2 years.
I agree. And if anything, that seems more certain to me than if you had said that about Harbaugh, because there's no Ohio State / Urban Meyer.
The one thing that could keep him out is Baker Mayfield has one more year at Oklahoma.
That's true.
I didn't mean to slight Bob Stoops there. I mean, obviously, he has tremendous career at Oklahoma. This is not circa 2008 Oklahoma. You know, they keep getting it done. To their credit, they got a chance to win, have a chance to win yet another Big 12 title this week. But I don't think they're, you know, Jim Harbaugh entered a conference where you have a program in Ohio State that is basically the Alabama of the North. I don't see Oklahoma in that way. So I think he's got a great opportunity there. Now, the domino of that, Ed Orgeron gets the job at LSU. You're a little biased, obviously.
Yeah, I know him probably better than anyone.
Yeah, you wrote a book with him. But so I'm, as the unbiased one, I'm just going to say that I think LSU, I think that's great. You know, people are going to say, oh, they got their third choice. They didn't get Herman. They didn't get Jimbo. And then the part I don't like at all is the people who are still hung up on his Ole Miss tenure. I mean, to me, he's not remotely the same coach he was then. His whole demeanor is different when you see him in these press conferences or post-game interviews. And frankly, if they get one more yard against Florida, he goes 6-1 as LSU's interim coach, having only lost to Alabama, and everybody is hailing this as the great hire. I didn't come up with this myself, so I can't take credit for it. People have said he could be LSU's version of Dabo Swinney, and I think that's a great analogy.
Yeah, I mean, the one difference, and I forgot who it was, but somebody who covers LSU did a story about all the guys who've been elevated up, you know, whether interims or not, or guys who were kind of in that role and maybe not expected to be the head coach and then get it. The one difference between Orgeron and almost all the guys, including Dabo Swinney, including, you know, I'm trying to remember who else was on there. It was a mixed bag of success. You know, Larry Coker led Miami to a national title, obviously then got fired, you know, a few years later. And there was, I want to say there was like 8 or 9 guys on there. The difference is Orgeron has head coaching experience, and the experience I think is unique in that I was talking to a friend of mine who's just like a columnist, not a college football person. And he said, what do you think? And I said, the biggest thing is for people who think he's the same guy who coached at Ole Miss and define him by that, either haven't been paying attention or just don't know what they're talking about. Because he's radically different from the guy he was at Ole Miss. I mean, I saw that up close. I spent a bunch of time around him when he was the interim head coach at USC. I was there on Thursday night and talked to a lot of people in College Station at the LSU A&M game. I mean, I know he's not the same head coach now. So does that mean he's going to win national championships there? No, it doesn't. The things I will say is, it means he is going to get a lot of players there because he's a great evaluator and great recruiter. And the players are going to play hard for him because we saw that. We saw the bounce back. For them to beat A&M as badly as they did without their best offensive player, without two of their best defensive players, I think was a big statement considering, you know, a lot of people thought they were going to kind of go in the tank after losing the way they did against Florida on the last play.
The other kind of lazy narrative out there is, you really think that's going to scare Nick Saban? I mean, if that's the criteria, then you might as well hire Hugh Freeze, because he's about the only coach recently who has put a consistent scare into Nick Saban. Yes, that is the goal. They want to beat Alabama. They want to win that division. But I don't know that there's any coach, Tom Herman included, that they could hire and say, yep, that is definitely the guy that's going to topple Nick Saban.
Yeah, what will be interesting is if, in fact, as part of Orgeron's plan that he presented to the AD Joe Oliva, on Friday morning was, I'm going to bring the best offensive coordinator in the country here, and that's Lane Kiffin. Taking, you know, it's not just addition by subtraction. I think it'd be very interesting how that would play in the SEC West. Lane Kiffin coaching against his old, I don't want to call Nick Saban his mentor, but he definitely learned from Nick Saban.
Well, let's get into that a little bit, because I don't think most people see that as realistic. They say, why on earth would he make a quote unquote lateral move? Why would he leave the best program in America to go work for another one in the same division?
You know, he's worked under Nick Saban for now 3 years, and they've had a lot of success together. But 3 years can be a long time. Nick Saban is not the easiest guy to work for. And I think to have added flexibility, not just in what he runs, but how he runs it and how he runs, you know, runs practice and how he works, I think that would give him, that's a selling point. By the way, and I don't know how big of a selling point this next thing is, but Orgeron's not going to make anywhere near the money they would have had to pay out for Jimbo Fisher, certainly. That additional $3 million that's left over, three plus, you know, that's going to go to, you know, likely Dave Aranda if he does in fact agree to this deal. and probably to Lane Kiffin. I mean, what I was told is those guys could get close to $2 million a year as coordinators.
Yeah, to your point about 3 years is a long time. I mean, you think people joked about it at the time, but you think Lane, how much do you think Lane enjoys those ass chewings, as Nick Saban referred to it, you know? I would think Ed Orgeron is a much more fun guy to have as your boss. It is funny that it was the other way around at Tennessee and USC.
I can tell you this. I've seen his ass chewings from his old Ole Miss staff. They were, you know, they make Nick Saban seem like Jim Grobe, but I don't think, like I said, I don't think that's the same guy that you know, people are going to work for now.
Any awkwardness at all over the fact that Kiffin was his boss at Tennessee and USC and now would be the other way around?
I don't know. I mean, I always thought they had a kind of an odd relationship because they're such different personalities. But I remember Orgeron spent 1 year as a D-line coach for the Saints. And I'm trying to remember, I was down in Louisiana for something. I went to see him at his house and he opened up a closet and he had all this orange stuff that Kiffin had sent him and his family just to recruit him for the job. And I think they've always had this, you know, his relationship with the Kiffins has been very close. Remember, Chris Kiffin, who's the D-line coach at Ole Miss now, early on, you know, Monty relied on Ed to help him kind of get settled in his coaching career. So from everything I've heard, I think that, you know, that's the direction things are looking like they're headed. But, you know, there's a long time between now and whenever the end of the season really is for Alabama, which we think is probably, you know, the second week of January.
So normally in college football, the Sunday after Thanksgiving is Black Sunday. I mean, it's the day that all the firings go down because now teams' regular seasons are over. And in part because LSU and Texas got settled on Saturday, there was almost nothing. I mean, we were the Nevada job, you know, the FAU job. Nothing really happened on Sunday or as of the fact time we're recording this, which is always dangerous to anything could change in the next few hours. But what, if anything, is the next domino? Obviously, I think we're all waiting on Oregon.
Oregon is the one domino. I mean, potentially, you know, look, there's it's not a firing, but we're going to see what direction Baylor goes. Houston is a very desirable, it's the most desirable group of five vacancy or job. And it's a lot more attractive than some Power Five jobs. Beyond that, you know, I'm not sure. There's rumblings of some different things that I'm a little skeptical of, certain things that are going to, you know, might come open. I don't think they're going to go in the directions I've heard, but you know, it's a rumor heavy time of year because there hasn't been much activity and because some of it happens so much earlier than normal.
Here's what I want to know. I mean, Tom Herman kind of overshadowed everybody else on this market, but PJ Fleck is an extremely hot coach. He's 12-0. He was on game day. He's crowd surfing in the locker room, and we know Purdue wants him. If you had to guess, where is PJ Fleck coaching next year?
There's a chance if Oregon does get rid of Mark Helfrich, and we'll probably know by the middle of the week if he's staying or not, that Oregon could look at PJ Fleck. It had been reported he was close with Purdue. We kind of, I don't want to say debunked that, but I had reported after that I was told there had been really no real contact between Purdue and PJ Fleck and that they were going to wait till after the conference title game before they kind of examine these things. And if you look at it that way, PJ Fleck's timing is probably pretty good. The question with him is he's 35. He's done a really terrific job in the MAC. Usually you do not jump from the MAC to a real, you know, a top 20 job. You have some intermediate step. Like Matt Campbell was a hot coach last year. Matt Campbell is at Iowa State. That is not Oregon, you know. So, I mean, that's basically kind of Purdue-esque of the Big
20. There actually hasn't been a great track record recently of you know, Mac has always been kind of the cradle of coaches, although that was specifically applied to Miami. But recently, I mean, Tim Beckman, Daryl Hazel, I guess Tino Babers, you know, came from there and he could still turn out to be. So I understand why it would give people pause, but I just do think that PJ Fleck is on a whole other. First of all, he's just such a different guy. We've never really seen a coach quite with this personality and this approach. He's, as people are saying, he's the millennial coach. And Western Michigan was terrible, just terrible when he took over. And they are 12-0. They're probably going to a New Year's Six Bowl. Which, by the way, when this new system was created, I thought that group of five berth would almost always be from either the American or the Mountain West. It would be awfully hard to do it from the MAC. But he beat two Big Ten teams, undefeated. Good for him. And I got to imagine he wants to cash in while his stock is hot.
Yeah, no question. And now I was told that there was a chance Western Michigan would try to get this up to low level Big Ten money and see if they could do what Houston did and hang on to him for one more season. Maybe there's a chance that happens if Oregon doesn't look at him.
Maybe he himself says, well, I could go to Purdue or I could wait a year. And because there just aren't that many openings. And I mean, look at how many coaches in the SEC alone have finished this season on thin ice, but are apparently going to hang on to their job. Butch Jones, Kevin Sumlin. You know, some of these major jobs could be open a year from now.
Yeah, but those jobs you're talking about, I think it's a domino effect that could matter, but they're not going to... PJ Fleck's not ending up no matter what happens next year in College Station.
You don't think if Western Michigan turns around, I don't think they're going to go undefeated again next year. Unless they have a really good season. 10-2, kind of like Tom Herman's second season at Houston, that he wouldn't be able to be the coach at Tennessee?
I don't know. That's a big jump.
It is, but I think at that point, first of all, I would imagine Tennessee fans would hire him today if they could.
Tennessee's fans would hire you today.
They are just, I cannot imagine what it's like right now after all the expectations they had for this season for it to not just end in 8-4, but end by losing to Vandy. It was a very humbling weekend for a lot of SEC teams. Georgia lost to Georgia Tech. Arkansas lost to Missouri. A&M gave up 50, more than 50 to LSU at home for their third straight SEC loss. It's just been kind of a miserable season for anybody not named Alabama. I actually threw this out today. How many fan bases in the SEC are happy with their season? And I would say it's Alabama, Kentucky, who they're on cloud nine, Vandy, South Carolina, because they were not expected to go to a bowl, and maybe Florida, yeah, maybe Auburn. You know, they just lost their rival. They're still a little three-loss team at a place that expects national championships. Certainly, if they were to beat Alabama, they would be elated. Auburn's going to probably go to the Sugar Bowl, and that's something to be excited about a year after 6-6, but they are 8-4 and lost to Alabama again. So it's just, I kept telling everybody, it's cyclical, it's cyclical. This thing will turn around at some point, and sure enough, it is a great season to be a fan in the Big Ten and just a miserable season for most of the schools in the SEC. All right, I think we need to end with, it was a very fun weekend at Fox, but your weekend actually started, obviously, at the Texas game, and you kind of went viral. And if people haven't seen this yet, go to Awful Announcing or just Google Bruce Feldman, Texas Band. And I was watching this live when it happened, and I panicked for you, frankly. You're doing a stand-up before the game, right as the Texas band is doing its pregame routine, and they got a little too close for comfort.
Yes. So a couple of things. First of all, you know, after I thought about it, I was like, I am surprised it happened, and B, I'm kind of surprised it hasn't happened before. So this season, the way you work as a sideline person is, most typically have what's, you know, part of the open. So you'll have one on camera thing. Usually it's right before kickoff or, you know, in the segment right when your announcers come on, they throw it down to you for, you know, 20 seconds on camera or whatever. And then, you know, you later will have another certain on camera hit at the start of the third quarter. This was part of our pregame show. And so I think I was on the field for that maybe, you know, an hour or 40, I was on the field the whole time, but maybe it happened 45 minutes before kickoff. So the band is, you know, is there, but because there were so many people on the Texas sidelines, you know, including Matthew McConaughey and all these other, you know, random people, but also recruits and family members and everything. It was also senior day. So you had all their families. There was a ton of people. And I saw in the Awful Announcing story that it was like, well, he should know better than just to stand wherever he wants. Well, that's not how it works. You don't just, hey, I'm a sideline reporter, so I'm going to stand in the middle of the field. You don't do that. Basically, wherever the camera people say, where is the ideal lighting, you do it. I was far down. I think I was like at the 10 or the 15. The Texas band is so big and there were so many people. I wasn't actually on like in the middle of the field. I was just like a step on from on the sideline. And when my hit started, I was actually more concerned about what was happening to my left, which were like recruits and recruits' families not realizing somebody's doing, you know, TV and just like accidentally not watching where they're walking and walking into the shot. And then as it goes on, you can hear, you know, obviously I hear the band playing throughout, but they're going through their march. And all of a sudden I can feel people like walking up literally to like where they're stepping on my right foot. And, you know, I'm there right next to me. And then I'm like, okay, listen, just focus into the camera on what you're saying. Try as best you can to listen to what Rob's question is. I thought this, I'm like, I'm definitely ending up on Deadspin and Awful Announcing as this thing is playing out. And I thought they were seeing the whole thing where like literally people are like, I'm the turning point where like they walk to me, bump me, and then turn around. And, you know, not realizing that also most of these band members, they can't see in front of you. They're just following the person in front of them. So it's almost like they probably don't even see me. You know, they're focused on what they're doing. So I couldn't hear Rob's third question. I tried to get through it as best I could. And it's all good, you know.
Beyond, though, like anticipating the possible embarrassment of this going viral, were you scared that you would get trampled?
No, I'm actually bigger than most of the guys and most of the people in the Texas band. That was not a concern of mine.
Okay. Because just watching on TV, it looked like that was a possibility. And Rob Stone, the look on Rob Stone's face when it goes back to him, he is giddy. He is absolutely giddy about what's happening.
Yes, he's a former sideline person. Yeah. He knows weird stuff can happen. You know, I'm more like, when you say trampled, I would be way more concerned. Like there's times when the team runs out on the field and sometimes those guys don't know, you know, they're running off in different directions. They may be looking into the crowd. I don't want some offensive lineman running up. I'm not too worried about like clarinet players, you know, or whatever.
Oh, great. You and Clay Travis being so condescending about band members.
No, I'm not being condescending. Look, I totally respect that was, you know, they were out there doing what they're doing. A lot of them, you know, I mean, they all work really hard to do it. I'm just like saying, physically, I'm way more.
You can take them. You could take them. I hear you.
No, it's not me saying I could take them. It's just the difference of, you know, you go, you know, people bump into you. It's fine. It's the idea of like, they're not running, let's put it that way. They're marching, they're moving at a, you know, relatively
true
close. Whereas I got some defensive end who's trying to fire up the crowd, looking in the crowd, running around in full pads, you know, with a 10-yard start. I'm going to go flying if he, you know, especially if I barely see him. The band member's just going to bump into me. I'll be okay.
So then we all convened in LA on Saturday for the playoff roundtable show. And, you know, this was a lot of people who aren't usually there on Saturdays. Most notably, your man, Tim Brando, Spencer Tillman, Joel Klatch, Shannon Spake, along with our usual Saturday crew of Leinart and Rob and Robert Smith, Coach Wanstedt. What stood out to you? What was your highlight of the day?
Just for me, as personal, was like, you know, I hadn't seen my kids for Thanksgiving because I was away. And then I didn't get to see them on Friday because I came home so late. I wasn't going to get to see them Saturday because, you know, I had to call. I had to leave the house at 5:30 to get in there. We were not going to get done late. So just to have my kids in there and like our guys are great with them, you know, like my son's favorite football player is going to be either Robert Smith or Matt Leinart, you know, because they're great to him and everything. So that was, you know, a part of it. But I just think it was like, it's a blast. I think one of the things that we all and the people listening to this would agree is you love about college football is it's a very shared experience. You get to watch games with your buddies. And that's what that was like Saturday, was watching it. But it was a fun experience to see that. The fact that there was a great game in the middle of it made it only better. So I'm glad. I'm sorry we don't get to do more of that, actually.
Yeah, I wish we could do that every week. Tim did steal the show. Not that I wasn't expecting. I mean, literally, like, took over that playoff show at points with his various conspiracy theories about the committee and branding, and which prompted a fantastic comeback by you at one point. Oh, also, I wanted to give a shout out to Shannon, who was on our podcast earlier this season. I know it was a very popular guest. We talked about how she, at the time, you know, she runs triathlons. She's just, you know, a warrior. But I could not believe the travel itinerary involved in this. They did the Apple Cup on Friday. So she flew from Charlotte to Pullman, which took, I believe she said, 11 hours. And it seems about as far a trip as you can make from one side of the country to the other, because you know how hard it is to get to Pullman. Then she flew down to LA for the day. Then she took a red eye home Saturday night to Charlotte. And then she was going to be in another very hard place to get to, State College, on Monday to do interviews leading into the Big Ten title game. Kudos to Shannon. That itinerary would kill me.
Yeah. Hey, look, we get to do something we love, and there's a trade-off there. And for her, she does college hoops then, and she's going to do motorsports, whereas you and I, it's all college football all the time. So
Hey, we're only a month away from my first bracketology edition.
Let me catch up on the bowl pairings. I need to know where my guy Frank Wilson at UTSA are going to end up.
I mean, everybody's waiting with bated breath to hear who's coming here for the Foster Farms Bowl, which is the only bowl on Fox. Is it going to be Indiana? Is it going to be Northwestern? Are they going to be playing Utah? Are they going to be playing Washington State? I know you're waiting to find that out.
Without question, I can't wait.
There was some breaking news, actually, right before we came on. Old Dominion, which only started its football program, I want to say, 5 years ago, less, is going to its first ever bowl game, and it is the Bahamas Bowl.
Good for Bobby Wilder. Good way to spend the holidays. I don't know. I mean, I don't know how soon that is, actually, right?
Yeah. No, I mean, it's that time of year. This is my week. I gotta, you know, I have to hope I pull this off better than the election pollsters did. We got through a lot there. We're gonna come back with you later this week. But as always, if you enjoy the Audible, please subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, or your favorite podcast app. And of course, send your emails to theaudiblepod@gmail.com. We will definitely hit the mailbag later this week. We'll see you next time.